Welcome to the Anime Podcast. This week we find ourselves moored in the Sea of Cortez on the lookout for Jeffrey Epstein. We believe his ghost has possessed a large, maybe 24-foot great white shark and is on the patrol for, well, things that Jeffrey Epstein looks out for. So we'll get back to you on how our hunt goes later in the episode. At the moment, we are still in isolation. I'm in the Sea of Cortez with our tugboat. Our intrepid Oisin, Will, and Vox Dulta are in Dublin, still. And this week's episode, we're going to be focusing on the issue of the oil prices, the fall in oil prices earlier last week, what effects it's going to have, what it had effects as it already had. But also, we're going to be discussing the rise of China in both the Middle East, Africa, and in general as a new superpower, one of the two or three, whatever we are in now. And we'll finish off with some light discussions of good, shitty movies. And there's plenty of those. So, so hopefully you enjoy our little attempts at anarchist and political discussions.
Okay, so what happened on Monday to oil prices and why did it happen? Who wants to come in first?
I suppose I can. So oil prices on Monday absolutely plummeted, to say the least. Not only plummeted to like small numbers, but actually plummeted to negative numbers.
Yeah.
There seemed to be two main reasons for this. The first was oversupply. And the second was lack of demand. These two things are obviously quite related. The minor issue in the background seemed to be the futures trading agreements were due to be cashed in on the Tuesday. So obviously the coronavirus is like, man, that demand for oil has massively plummeted. No one is traveling to work. Planes aren't flying. Tankers aren't. What do tankers do? Tank? Sail? Well, they don't sail. Whatever it is tankers do, they weren't doing it. Trains aren't running to the degree they are. And as a direct consequence of this, demand just dried up. The response to this was basically to turn oil production down to 9.7 million barrels a day. Now, if you think about how much... Was it, 9.7 billion barrels a day? Or was it million? I think it was million.
Million.
How much oil normally sells for, and that is like, the status quo was normally around about $100 a barrel. 9.7 million times $100 a barrel is what? $970 million a day. That is how much the oil industry would have been worth when the barrels were worth that amount of money. Falling to $20 a barrel and like you're wiping a fifth off or like you're wiping four-fifths off the value of the market and then it dropping to negative sums of money and you get a sense of how serious a deal this is for the financial markets. It's absolutely staggering.
Yeah.
But it should be said that at this point, it should be said that the price of barrels within, was it a day or two afterwards, had gone back up to about $10.23. So it didn't stay, it should be said, it shouldn't stay at that price.
Yeah, good.
Anything I've read about it seems to suggest, well, again, anything I've read, people are going, you know, no, nothing to see here. It'll be fine by June. The next big kind of deadline is June, and they go, oh no, it'll be, you know, for barrels coming in the, for sale, etc. And they go, oh no, it'll be fine by June, you know. And people go, well, what if it's not fine? They go, well, it will be fine. We're not there. So that's kind of where it is right now.
It's, I've got not
got minus 37.
You got a lot of paper in your head in the sand.
Yeah. And sorry, Will, just from my own reading of the collapse in oil, it was a really tensions between Russia and Saudi Arabia that initiated this in the OPEC meeting last week, and it obviously Saudi Arabia ratcheted up their production, and they said, listen, we can handle a low cost of oil. But you can't. And then Russia said, yeah, that's fine, okay, we can do that too. And that's partly the reason and the context behind it.
So like basically like these two massive powers, like these oil producing powers, were like trying to outcompete each other where there's low demand. So the Americans, behind closed doors apparently, have told the Saudis to keep oil production up to keep the market price down, because the Americans reckon that low oil prices will hurt Russia more in the longer term.
Yeah.
And they can keep Saudi Arabia as fluid as they want. They'll just like keep buying their oil and like offering them cut price weapons and things in return. The intention for that was to like absolutely obliterate Russia's economy. Now, oil prices sitting around $40 a barrel means something like 500 oil producing companies will go bust within the next 2 months. Oil prices being cut to $20 a barrel means around about 1,000, maybe 1,500 companies go bust within the next 2 months. Oil prices like being quote unquote inflated to the dizzying heights of $10 a barrel, that's just unsustainable. It's like not a profitable company anymore to be selling oil at $10 a barrel. So yeah. These, like, everyone's saying, oh, you know, the market's kind of recovered and the oil price has gone back up to positive figures. It's not gone up by much, and it's not gone up by enough.
Yeah.
But the argument people would, just to be the devil's advocate or capitalist advocate, same thing, basically. But to make the point, they will say, is they'll say, look, well, we were at 100 million barrels, whatever it was a day, I think it was 100 million barrels or 100 million gallons or whatever it was of oil a day. We've gone down to 60 or 70 million, you know, we've gone down 30% because of the coronavirus. And they're saying, oh, well, you know, there's already signs that the demand is growing because people are starting to go back to work in America. And they're saying, you know, Will has said it before, lots of people have said it before, they're going to force people back, regardless of the coronavirus, they'll force people back to work in America because let's not be, you know, flippant about it. They don't give a shit what happens to poor people. So they'll force them back to work and they think, well, then they'll be consuming oil and problem solved. So that's their point of view, is this is a temporary thing. In June, you know, this problem will not be here. So whatever we might be saying right now, that's what they will be saying in return, that this is only a temporary blip. So I just to be the devil's advocate, that's what they're saying.
What's actually great about this is the market data has been pretty damn consistent since March 2014, that oil prices are absolutely plummeting and demand has been reducing since 2014. Prices have been reducing from 2014. The coronavirus has accelerated the rate at which crisis has hit, but it's certainly not like the systemic cause of it. So American oil companies are done. If I'm being really pessimistic, they'll keep on dragging for a while, but every energy producing company is going to look at, from now, it's going to look at ways to start making their portfolios more diverse, because they know oil's finished. They're going to be looking at green energy. They're going to be looking at all sorts of things, but oil's finished.
And do you think that that if oil prices remain low, will this happen again in June? And if so, will the oil industry in America go bust?
Yeah, absolutely. There's been no fix. $10 a barrel is lower than what it was before Monday to precipitate this. So $10 a barrel is still far too cheap to make this a sellable product. Storage is at capacity. Weirdly, the one industry that's massively benefited from this oil collapse has been tankers. All these oil companies have started like investing loads of money in shipping companies for storage reasons. And it's just a storage problem. Like,
I was reading something today that they're going to run out of capacity on the ships in 2 weeks. So,
oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Great. Well done, capitalism.
So, this could be an additional thing. So I think most of them would say, is there any, the obvious question to ask, if there is a problem in June, a really big, you know, end of the world problem for them, is there any way to bail them out? Would the Fed try and bail them out, basically?
I don't know how they can. Like, the oil companies, firstly, aren't American. Well, they're not all American. WTI is obviously an American company. That mostly determines the price, or like that's like the official setter for the price of oil.
Royal Dutch Shell Company, and you know, you have lots of sort of European based companies as well. So
yeah, and there's going to be not a single country on the planet that's going to want to take that kind of hit. I mean, even if you give if you say to the oil companies, we will buy the oil from you, God knows where we're going to store it. But if we're going to give you the money to keep yourselves fluid, like, you're talking like so many trillions of dollars at that point that it would put any individual company, any individual country at such a financial disadvantage, because now suddenly that country's got an enormous debt, in which isn't important on its own. But in relation to other countries, it becomes important. The relation becomes important. And America are so paranoid about, you know, the rise of China, the potential for Russia to like re-emerge from this spine, that they just won't take the hit, and no one will take the hit. And if you're a small country watching everyone, all the larger countries taking the hit on your behalf, you'll just take a step back and watch them all take up this debt as you free ride off the back of it.
I completely agree. And I think it's interesting to note that the price of oil at the pumps hasn't really gone down in Ireland. in fact, it stayed stagnant, because I filled my car up yesterday and it's still 1.38. So
you're a murderer. Those of us who can't drive are so much better than people like you.
oh no.
Yes.
But anyway.
And what do we think this means for capitalism, and then also for green energies in the future?
So firstly, before we even start talking about that, I want to give a special shout out to my car, which is, I named cars. My first car was called Jimmy Carr, you know, like the comedian. I say comedian.
The second, Tax Dodger?
Pardon, thank you. The second car was Alan Carr. Wait, was that the first one? The second one was Alan Carr or Jimmy Carr. I forget which way around it went.
Alan Carr is presumably a parody of a car, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Like, I think it was a really bad Audi that blew up. And my most recent car is a red and a black car, and it's obviously called Karl Marx.
Red and black Karl Marx. He hated anarchists. That makes no sense.
I couldn't think of like a relevant anarchist-based car pun, so... So yeah, like it was Karl Marx.
You got a lot of options there.
And we'll get back to you at the end of the podcast on a new name for your car.
Yeah.
So what does this mean for capitalism? Firstly, I think it's quite clear that capitalism's sort of really in a lot of trouble on many fronts. And then Antonio Gramsci wrote about the interregnum after the death of one order. And while the new order cannot be born. So, and he said that morbid symptoms appear. And I think this is one of the morbid symptoms he was talking about. But where do we go from here? I mean, capitalism's dead, hooray. But do we really want to be going into a world of sort of state-sponsored surveillance and stuff? You know?
I would like to hear what Dimitri has to say.
Yeah.
Just a couple of questions for Will or Adrian, actually. First of all, Will, do you see this as a U.S. crisis or a crisis for the U.S. and their allies, or a global one? And the second question is, do you think that the Trump government would prefer to nationalize the oil industry, at least for a short term, in order to save them from the crisis?
This is an election year, after all.
So the first question was, is this a problem mostly for America and their allies? I would say, yeah, it probably is. Russia's economy is super weak and really fragile. But, you know, like, oil hasn't really done much to change that anyway.
And China's going to benefit from it.
Oh, yeah, I was about to say that. China's is the biggest oil importer in the world.
So they're an oil importer, so they're loving it because oil's going to be piss cheap for them.
Yeah.
So they're going to be, like, drinking up the second everything kind of returns back to normal-ish. They're just going to be absolutely drinking.
China, don't drink the oil, okay?
Look, if I can inject protectant into my veins, then a Chinese person has the right to drink a glass of oil if they want. What was the second question?
That's the official anarchist position on bleach.
No, the second question is in relation to Trump government. And do you think that they would nationalize the oil industry in order to help them, to save them, actually, from the crisis?
Yeah, maybe. So, like, that's that is an option for them, I suppose. It doesn't really get rid of the problem, but it will bail out his mates. So, if he just wants to say to his friends, "Look, we'll buy your companies, we'll run them at a loss. Here is $20 billion for you and your family. Good luck to you in the future." Americans are really against nationalizing things, though. And, like, it would just take one person to say socialism and a really scary voice, preferably with a Russian accent, in front of, like, a red flag, maybe in front of my car, then I think that policy would be dead. But yeah, it's a really creative response.
I would disagree in only one way, which is that Trump is a cult leader and it doesn't matter what he says. He can spin anything to his sheep of followers, to be honest with you. He can turn on a dime, as they say in the States. If he suddenly says tomorrow, "I'm going to nationalize things," but he doesn't use the word nationalize, Fox News will run with it because Fox doesn't give a shit about anything other than the bottom line. And if there's money to be saved by nationalizing, they'll do it. In my mind, they'll do it. They don't care.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he wants to, like, is there a connection between the oil companies and the disinfectant companies that you could maybe... Yeah, I'm not really sure, but, like, yeah, no, I suspect you're right. Like, Trump can literally say whatever he wants. Didn't he say just before the election that he could take out a gun and shoot someone on air and it wouldn't matter?
Yeah, he did. He did.
He also said in an interview with Playboy in 1999, don't ask me how I know this, he said that if I was to ever run for president, I'd run for the Republican Party because their voters are idiots.
Classic.
Yeah.
I mean, what can you say?
Yeah.
Was he a member of the Republican or the Democratic Party back then?
He was a member of the Democratic Party in the 90s.
Yeah.
There you go.
There you go. But I mean, I think from what it does to capitalism is that I think Will was saying this. We probably shouldn't keep throwing this to Will because it sounds like Will is our cult leader. But he's the only one who understands economics amongst us that I know of. Anyway, but he did say that in terms of where investment's going to go, I mean, I was shocked to learn that coffee is the second most traded thing or whatever the exact thing is. But in terms of investments, it's possible to move them into something that's maybe a bit more stable. Green energy, from what I can tell, is a good alternative for some of that money. But the thing that I would want to know is it possible in the short term that they're going to make those types of changes? Are they not going to just ride this thing down to the bottom of the canyon? I don't see them making the type of wide decisions. I mean, nothing about traders speaks to me of thought out wisdom, you know? That's the real problem, you know? You could make a change, it could be saved. I mean, Bernie Sanders, much like FDR, if he'd been elected, would probably have, you know, made sure capitalism survived longer. But because of this kind of insane drive for growth and profit, you know, disregarding everything else, that's what's going to destroy it, you know?
Mm.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I don't see what other options they've got other than, like, investing in green, because they need to invest in energy somewhere. Like, everyone needs energy. It's one of these, what's it called? Or, like, an essential product or whatever. If they invest in green energy, then that's going to screw them in the long term as well, because the second they've got unlimited renewable energy, the price drops because it's a state of abundance. I don't know. It seems that the banks can't really do anything to like reclaim their invested capital, other than move away from oil.
You mean you have to operate at a loss? That's madness.
Yeah.
Undemocratic.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, and what do we think about this? How this affects Trump's chance of re-election? I mean, he is against a lame duck in Joe Biden, but does it have any effect on Trump's chance of re-election?
I just want to add the words rapist or paedophile to lame duck.
Yes, well, the mother duck does reproduce by gang rape, so, you know.
There you go. True.
Oshin, 2020, the mallard duck. Anyway.
The mallard duck of the Democratic Party. I think that's all sort of well and good and stuff, but I don't think this is just, I know American oil share prices have dropped considerably, but in the medium term, I think this might be the stimulus that Western countries, European countries, and even emerging markets as well need. I know. I said emerging markets. They're actually countries that they need to sort of pivot towards a greener agenda.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, yeah, that's just true. It's just a statement of fact. Like a lot of emerging markets, I think capitalism doesn't see them as countries. It just does see them literally as markets.
Yeah.
Just treat this as like, this thing's dead. Normally the mode of economic growth is to piggyback or leapfrog, and I think it's going to be any different.
Yeah.
I think what we really need to worry about is how does this affect Dick Cheney? Because obviously he has a million people's bodies on his...
He'll just shoot another lawyer in the forest, you know, it'll be fine.
You can't let this go. I killed people.
Yeah.
We kind of are ignoring the state in this because the state, obviously, in Europe or in the European Union, is going to take the view whenever it wants. And yeah, again, money printer go brr. If there's a way to get around this, and even if it involves nationalization or involves whatever, they'll do it. I mean, none of this is a big deal. It never was. You know, it's always been ideology that drove this, never common sense, and never any real thing of, oh, we can't afford it. So I think they'll throw money at this, they'll nationalize things, they'll do whatever. I think we're kind of underestimating what they'll do in the short term to get through this, because they don't see it as a systemic issue. It's just a temporary issue. And so they'll throw whatever they're going to need to throw at it.
They'll treat the symptoms, not the disease, you know.
Yeah. I think estimating what they're going to do to try and keep the status quo. If it means in the short term the status quo has to be put into hibernation, they don't care. I mean, you know, most mainstream, I mean, Macron was on the other day, and he goes, let's just print tons of fucking money. You know, who cares? You know, we just, seriously, like, I think we're underestimating what they view this as. Or now, again, they can't just make completely rewrite the rules. There's going to be a cost for doing that. But I really do see, you know, hyperinflation being a real problem. I think printing tons of shucky money is already become the go-to, and they're going to keep doing that, even if it means they got shit tons of debt. I think that's what they're going to do.
But it's not just printing loads of money. It's also austerity and imposing austerity on nations, you know, which is completely the wrong way to go about things. The UK just passed 200,000 deaths from coronavirus in, I think it was yesterday?
20,000.
Is that actually 41,000? To be honest with you, didn't the day here that there was excess deaths in the UK has been 41,000?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's because the UK aren't counting deaths that don't happen in a hospital.
Yeah.
Which is the majority of deaths. So the Scottish Parliament did publish those figures, and everyone went ballistic, because if those figures are accurate for the rest of the UK, then that number is going to be something like 50,000. But the Office for National Statistics, the official government body, said if you look at, you know, the data that they do have that has been corrected for population size, they think is somewhere around about 41,000 dead. Just absolutely staggering. Absolutely staggering. And not one of them was Boris Johnson, the Queen, Prince Charles, or any of them. I'm not wishing death upon people publicly, but, you know, come on.
Isn't that the other part of this, which is that the answer to making sure that oil demand goes up is ending lockdown? And does anyone think the Tories won't do that or the Republican Party won't do that? The Republican Party's already doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all part of this, is increased demand. But you need to increase it to before 2014. Because, again, this isn't just a blip. This is like a trend that's been happening since 2014. You need to increase oil demand to more than 2014.
Yeah, because the population has grown since then, you know, exponentially even. So,
yeah. You need to get like India to stop investing in renewables and Brazil to stop doing stuff with renewables and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
A random kind of cynical thought. Don't wars demand large amounts of oil?
Oh, man, they do. They're normally falling.
A nice little well-placed war. That'd be nice. That would solve a lot of the demand problem, wouldn't it?
Anyone you want to go to war with?
Iran.
There's always somebody. Iran's a good one, you know?
Iran is perfect because they're isolated in their own region and also among the great powers. And, you know, they have oil, so that it would pay more than pay for itself. But it's a really, really bad move because the Iranians don't take stuff lying down.
No.
But the thing that might lead into our discussion later about China is I don't see them standing in the way of that. And the Russians might be going, do you know what? We need to stimulate oil demand too. Do you know what? I don't really care if a couple of 100,000 Russians die if we have a war and it solves our economy problems, you know. I could see it happening, man. I could absolutely see it happening if it got bad enough.
Yeah, I think that Iranians definitely view Russia with suspiciously because, you know, currently they are one of the only countries buying Persian oil, but at the same time they didn't really treat them fairly in the period up to 1979, and then isolating as well. So I think it will be interesting to look and see what happens with Iran, if there's any rapprochement from Iran over the next while, but I don't think so because they're having an election this summer and they've already ruled out most of the reformist candidates. So I can't see a sort of another Rouhani coming along.
Depressing. Me too, you're gonna... and I suppose like an obvious thing to ask and throw out there is how do we, if oil takes a nosedive, or at the very least the companies that are refineries and the traders take a nosedive, and there is actually reduced supply in parts of the world because who's pumping it is you can't make any money from it. Other than, again, assuming they don't nationalize it. Let's just assume they don't. So we'll have to make some very, a lot of people have to make some very big changes in their life. Most obviously of all being Oisin and Will, who have cars. And also, sorry, pardon me, and Dimitri, you all have cars.
Yeah,
sure. I'm a much better person than you are.
I'm a person who didn't.
You guys have to make.
Yes.
I'm too lazy to learn to drive. But you know what I mean? Like the people have to make major changes in their lives in terms of how much they, maybe not giving up your car, but how much you can actually use it. You know, if it's costing way more, which presumably way off more than bumping it, you know?
Well, it's actually funny that it's almost the complete opposite to the 1970s with the price wars. And yet people are still going, God, we really need to rethink how we use our energy and stuff. So, I think it will be interesting to see how Europe, the UK, and the US respond. I don't think they'll respond exactly the same, but I think most of the responses will be the same.
Dimitri, were you going to say something?
In relation to iron, I know that they are probably the best enemy to have for always available, you know, for a good argument. And of course, it would be a great help for Trump to have iron as an enemy. However, we all know that they have been doing military missions with Russia and China, so I'm not sure if they will be picked as an enemy. Ocean mentioned previously about emerging markets. I presume, Ocean, that you were referring to Africa?
Sorry, which?
You were referring previously to emerging markets. Were you referring to Africa?
Africa and Asia, yeah.
I'd say Africa might be the next war field for any type of war, either real war or trade war. Capitalism is looking for new markets, and Africa is probably the only virgin part of the world at the moment for them.
Yeah. So,
and given what's happening in the world right now, like coronavirus, so it's a health issue, and the oil crisis, which is an energy issue, I think these are the two biggest things that capitalist society or capitalist markets fight for. So Africa is probably the best world for them to, you know.
Just on that, Dimitrios. Africa has been the seat of Chinese investment for about 20 years now, and China had so much money invested in sort of the rare earth minerals and stuff, the market there, that I don't think it would be tenable to have an invasion of. And also, if you look at Libya and Syria and sort of places. Mm-hmm. Places like that, you can see what happens if you topple a dictator as well. So yeah, I don't think there'd be much appetite in the US to attack on China's
not military, but what about financially?
Financially, yeah, sure. I mean, it's war by any other means, but I could see that happening. Yeah,
cool.
Okay.
In terms of finish that. In terms of positivity, because there's some positivity that can be gleaned from this, is it not much easier to argue if you believe in green energy, at the very least, if not like a complete transformation of society, that these things do go bust? I mean, sometimes the change doesn't happen because you argue coherently, but because things are forced, that they go bust, and therefore, okay, what are we going to do as an alternative? People won't make the change until they're forced to make the change. Doesn't this in some way help that? Maybe.
Why do you hate Alan Carr? Sorry. Why do you hate Karl Marx so much?
I don't hate Karl Marx.
Car alone. I'm looking to get a new car anyway, but I do love my crappy car.
Like you hate crappy Marx.
Yeah, quite.
Just on that, Alex, I think it is an incentive, but because it's not being driven by the state, it's being driven by markets. People are sort of more cautious about, you know, trusting it, because if the states turn around and say, listen, we found $1 trillion from the whatever, and we're going to prop up the oil industry, they'll feel a bit stupid. So, I don't know.
Well, a good point we should bring up in another podcast, not this one, that the Green Party, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, look likely to be in a coalition. If the Greens say you need to do X, Y, and Z, it looks good on paper. Whether they actually get any of that is a big if, but let's be optimistic and say they do. Hallelujah, they found the secret to getting past Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. But it would be a huge thing if we kind of made that transition now, because we, as things are, and this is something we'll talk about another time, but we are bottom of the list, I think, in Europe in terms of our hitting our carbon reduction targets. So again, something for another podcast, but it maybe gives us the potential to argue with people about moving to a carbon-free economy. Because at this point, we have to do that. We should have been doing it for 30 years. We need to do it. I'm trying to be optimistic about this. Maybe it has that effect if it goes belly up, you know?
And you think the Green Party are going to pursue that?
No, I don't. I'm saying it gives us the potential to argue it, not that the Green Party will succeed in doing that. Look, we all need salads on our back windows, you know? We need salads. Look, we make friends with salad, and we also make revolutionary change with salad. So, you know, stop smirking.
Yeah.
Dimitri, what were you going to say?
Just thinking out loud, am I correct in saying that the oil crisis, one of the factors for this oil crisis, is actually the decrease in demand because of the decrease in traffic worldwide?
Yeah, definitely.
Cars are all grounded at the moment. Is oil crisis so far this week massively, but it should be one of the factors. So probably if it is, then this will force states to move towards green energy in a capitalist way, of course, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, definitely. So, like, I think one of the worries I've got from this is that let's assume that oil is finished and that within the next 10, 15 years, we all move towards a green energy source. My concern is that the people motivating and driving this change aren't communities and people and, you know, an increase in social consciousness. It's capitalists out to make a buck. And they have, as a, you know, tendency, stifled projects in the past that have looked like they can't produce an energy abundance because it's a threat to their monopoly and it's a threat to their market. And I just don't trust them to, like, make that transition to green energy in the future. I looked at buying a BMW i8, not because I can afford it, but, like, you know, I thought that'd be a cool car to have. It looks like it was designed in the near future by some drawing anime. I wonder how much that car costs. It's an electric car, you know, good for the environment, better for the environment, all that kind of stuff. It was like 150 grand or something. It was like an obscene amount of money. Again, like, if people want to donate to the podcast, I don't know if they can, but, you know, but, you know, like, capitalism will work out a way to stop a state of abundance happening. So we need to take the lead and we need to be the ones to drive the change, not companies and not even the state, I would say.
Certainly. Agreed. Last question for me. What do you think will happen to countries where the oil industry is like a monocultivation for them, like Saudi Arabia, for example?
Oh, yeah, they're done. Saudi Arabia will have, like, what is their income going to be going forward? Where are they going to make any money? I suppose, like, they can just keep on going to war with Yemen.
And they've also been a victim of their own success in that, you know, they haven't really invested in education, in the arts or anything. It's simply Mecca and oil is their only two commodities that they have. And I don't think there'll be too much of an increase in demand to go to Mecca after this.
And what if they change their lives in the future?
Ooh. I like that.
What do they want, Corey?
Well, I think Saudi Arabia has certainly been an ally of the United States and Israel for the last about 10, 15 years, and they've held China in a bit of a long finger, but they've held them in the long finger. They don't really trust China too much because they have experience of China in Africa. And they see them as quite rapacious and stuff. So I'm not sure that even Mohammed bin Salman will want to sort of lump his lot in with Saudi Arabia or with China.
Great.
And that's the only ally I can see them as potentially having.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't see the Saudis having much options at all. Like Will said, but they're done. I mean, their entire economy, their whole power is based on one thing. If that one thing ceases to be of value, you know, the whole world will be different. I mean, we haven't even talked about the petrodollar, you know. Again, do we even have time to talk about the petrodollar and how much American money is flushing around the world And again, it does that survive? I don't think so. In which case, the world would be a very, very different place if it doesn't. You know, I mean, all that money.
Let's not forget that they've been really extrovert the last few years, you know, buying teams in the Premier League, for example, or airlines or everything. So
that's the UAE, actually. It's not Saudi.
That's why I'm thinking about the new era there. I don't know. I'm pretty sure they're trying to find ways to escape from that dead end, but I don't know how.
Yeah, I mean, like the purchasing of football teams and like these like luxury companies are mostly... I might be wrong, but I think they're like status indicators, more than like sound financial investments. I don't think they're buying like, I know like next to nothing about football. I know one thing about football, and that is that Rangers are the worst. if you're a Rangers fan, you are the worst person in the world. That is the only thing I know about football. But as I understand it, no one is buying football teams because it's a sound financial long-term investment. They're buying them because it's a status indicator. It's like I was going to say a flashy car, but like I think I've spoken enough. I sound like I'm like working for the car lobby. I think that's what they're doing. Interestingly, I think the UAE have got the largest solar field in the world. I don't know what they're going to do with that. Like it's not like they can. I don't see what they can. What they can do at the moment. I don't even see what they could do within 5 years.
So before we finish up this section, if we are finishing up this section, can I just ask Will, because he knows more about this than anyone, someone else knows more about it. Does this affect the way the petrodollar works and how about the issue of the American dollar as a reserve currency, do you think?
So currency is measured in terms of barrels of oil at the moment. So like we tend to like work out how stable the financial markets are. In terms of like the barrel of the oil mark is like a unit of confidence essentially, which again it hasn't really had since 2014, but it is the most largest and most circulated commodity in the world. Coffee is the second most traded commodity in the world, and I don't see there being a shortage of coffee anytime soon. However, if that does become the standard by which all things are measured, the price of my coffee better not bloody go up, because like if there's one thing I enjoy more than cars, it's a cup of coffee. I don't know. America, the United States, that is, doesn't really grow coffee beans. Like it doesn't have the climate for it. Mm. However, Cuba does. And it would be amazing if if Cuba suddenly became a super advanced techno society off the back of like, you know,
Wakanda.
Yeah, it'd be great. It'd just be great. I think, I don't know, American power as measured in barrels of oil is done. They're going to start thinking about the next thing. I reckon it'll be coffee. If it's not coffee, it will be wheat. Wheat makes more sense to me. But, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
By the way, the coffee industry worldwide has been in a crisis since last year.
It's because that hasn't gone out as much.
Was the sound of me harpooning and then shooting El Pez del Diablo, the devil fish, otherwise known as a great white shark possessed by Jeffrey Epstein. Unfortunately, his spirit fled the scene quite soon afterwards, and we're back on the hunt for him in our next episode. But before we get there, the second half of the podcast will be focusing on the issue of China, as we discussed in the intro, and its role in basically the world right now.
Okay, so welcome to the second half of the podcast. Now we are talking about the China question. And mainly we're focusing on China's involvement in the Middle East through the Belt and Road Initiative and American pushback against that, and also how they will benefit from the oil crisis. So I think we'll go first to Dimitrios raised a question, which is, why is China the number one enemy for the West, especially the US? Who would like to get in on that?
I can start if you like. Just to give some background on China before we answer the questions. So we all remember that back in 2008, the big economic crisis started in the US, right? Mm-hmm. China back then was the world's factory, producing mm-hmm. all low quality products, cheap flip-flops and mobiles that could explode. Am I correct? From what I remember, China faced a big trouble in the next 2 years, 2009 and 2010, because the demand from all over the world just decreased. So they had to take some decisions there. One of the biggest decisions they made was to find a new market, and they found this market in the interior, China. Interior China was way behind the coastal provinces. It was really poor, while the coastal provinces were not rich, but they were in a very good position. You know, they could actually feed the world. So that happened after 2008, there, after 2010, actually, there. They increased consumption, and actually, the next coming years, they made the decision to conquer the world. How are they going to do that? In 2013, as you said, Ocean, the Belt and Road Initiative was signed. It was mm-hmm. a big plan, a very promising plan for China, because they are trying actually to connect about 70 countries worldwide in Europe, Asia, and Africa. We talked briefly about Africa mm-hmm. previously. We know what's happening there, but what's happening in the EU? We have to say that China has already been the main player in Greece and Italy, because they have bought all the harbors there, all the ports. Mm-hmm. They control everything. Everything that goes into Europe through the sea comes from China or is controlled by China. That's a big movement, if I can say that, in the chessboard of the world. And then the biggest initiative that they have decided to do is a strategic plan called Made in China 2025. That was decided back in 2015. It is actually a combination of two five-year plans. Don't get me wrong. We know that five-year plans in the USSR failed, mm-hmm. but they are very successful for the Chinese now. They decided back in 2015 to move away from being the world's factory, as I said, low-quality goods, and move to, let's say, a high-tech country, producing aerospace, IT services, and of course to achieve independence from foreign suppliers for such products and services. The first five years have passed. We are in 2020 now, and I think they're in a good way to achieve their goal. I don't know if this is going to happen, but the first five-year plan is successful for them. They have huge focus on high-tech fields, IT, robotics, pharmaceutical industry, automotive industry, and the Chinese government is committed to invest about $300 billion in that big plan. Again, it's called Made in China 2025. It sounds ridiculous, but it's been very successful for them so far. Now, going back to your first question, why is China the enemy for the West? Because of all these plans, China is now the straight competitor to the US and the EU. Mm-hmm. Russia is very neutral at the moment. Even though they are affected by all these plans, they prefer to be closer to China as an ally, not an ally, but not an enemy anyway, while the US, you know, are going against them. And the EU is a bit neutral, a bit closer to the US, as I see it. And how I see this new war against China, we see the tariffs that Trump imposed after 2 years in government. That was the first kickback from the US. That's my very, very brief opinion on that. It's it is a trade war. It's not going to end anytime soon. Now, I believe that it'll be a win-win situation for everyone, apart from the working class, because the working class always loses, I think.
Mm. Yeah, true.
So can we, is it possible, because that's a lot of information that I want to, that I need to answer the question, that Ashin, can repeat the original question?
Yeah, so why is China the number one enemy for the West, especially the US?
Well, it seems to me from a historical perspective, which is probably where I should stick, that for basically safe bet 1600s, 1700s, when colonization of North and Central, South and Central America began, that China was one of the most, if not the world's largest economic and political player before then, as was India, by the way. India had 25% of GDP of the world before the 1600s, 1700s. So again, it was a different world, maybe one that's closer to what we have now. But for those period of time, because of industrialization, because of spread of empire and colonization, the West, Europe, and then spreading to European colonists in North America, which of course becomes the United States, they've dominated the sphere. So any threat to that, any threat at all, even if it made some people in Europe and America wealthier, again, is seen as a threat. So even while China becomes the workshop of the world back in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, they are still viewed as a threat because it's a kind of a cultural, almost tribalistic, imperial narrative. So that's the thing that's quite interesting about the way China is viewed from Europe and America. It's almost like an existential, if China becomes the number one economy, if it becomes whatever else, you know, the Belt and Road Initiative, if it succeeds, it's almost as if that, you know, weird, you know, kind of imperial 300-400 year period has come to an end. And that's why I think is that the real issue with China. I don't think it's an issue of competing forms of capitalism, though that's certainly there. I think it's grounded in this kind of, I don't want to say white supremacist, but it is heavily, you know, based on the fact Europe's white and European civilization, and by extension America, competing against the old world champion, the world champion who held the title longer than anybody, which was China. I mean, I think it's heavily that, personally.
Hmm. I would certainly agree that there is sort of an Occidental-Oriental divide, and people mistrust the Chinese because of that. But it's also more fundamental than that, more basic, that, you know, these people are producing goods at half the price that we are in the West, and they're making massive gains and massive inroads into territory that was considered for many years to be, you know, our bread and butter in Europe and the US. And China's just completely changed the model, changed the game. So yeah, I think it'll be interesting. And what is different in Chinese capitalism to the rest of the world? Anyone want to take that?
Yeah, I suppose China as a country participate in a world scale free market, but obviously internally they don't really have a free market. It's very much a planned economy. In the same way, like Walmart is a planned economy, and in the same way Amazon is a planned economy, China don't have like a business as such, but like that is how they run their economy. And where like America doesn't, it's just like free enterprise or whatever. Like it's not a centrally planned economy in the same way. I don't know if Dimitri's got more to say.
The main difference between the Chinese capitalism and the rest of the world is that the Chinese are very pacifists compared to the US hegemony. I think that the Chinese haven't been involved in any war so far. And that looks like they're approaching the market in a very, very different way than the rest. Of course, it's state capitalism that makes China a completely different situation to the US. And let's not forget that the whole culture is different. So they know how to control people. I'm not saying that the Europeans or the Americans are better than that. I'm pretty sure that China is the wet dream of all capitalists in the West world, but they can't achieve it at the moment. But I see that China has everything on their side in order to conquer the world in a very, very pacifist way.
Yeah, like through markets. I suppose like they're internally not pacifist. They're pretty aggressive to their own population. Yeah.
But definitely.
You can control, you can control other countries by just like waving cheap goods at them. Something I find super interesting is the Chinese model of like acquiring wealth was the aggressive exploitation of their own workers. You know, like again, Marx's labor theory of value kind of comes in. If you pay your workers nothing, the rate of exploitation increases and therefore increases your wealth. You can like sell a load of cheap products then to Western markets and then make a load of money off it. It just, again, like supports this view. Alex?
Yeah, I wanted to raise an obvious point, which is that some of the things we read to prepare for this podcast, because we, believe it or not, read things, was a kind of, I think, fairly American-centric article. It was a long one, and it made reference to the fact that Europeans and Americans should be able to basically bring China into a new arrangement or into the existing arrangement. And they talked about one of the problems of China being is they don't encourage democracy. Now, again, anyone who has any awareness of history or what that actually means when Americans say democracy and spreading democracy in the Middle East or spreading it anywhere, we all know what that actually means. But it is interesting that that's their model. The model is a parliamentary or some type of federal system. It's basically what they set up, what the Americans set up in Iraq. But with, you know, privatized the or previously nationalized oil industry, open everything up to American capital and to Western capital. So their problem with China is that maybe somewhat more successful in courting supporters, satellites, if you will, in terms of where they're spreading, because they don't demand that. They say to people, look, we will, as long as we're doing business, you know, I may well try and take advantage of you, but I'm not going to change the political system. I'm not going to demand, you know, you adopt my model. So I think maybe the thing that's interesting about them is compared to what the Americans did, which was basically trying to shove a particular, you know, form of political system down people's throats, is the Chinese, because they don't have the type of military power that America has right now, they probably will at some point, they're not demanding that. And it is, you know, people have reached a point where, and maybe countries have reached a point where they're sick to the teeth of Americans lecturing them on these issues when everyone and their mothers knows America's an oligarchy. It's not a democracy. Everyone knows that. Even Americans are beginning to see that, you know? So it's Chinese don't demand that. It's as long as you do business with us, we're fine, basically. So I think that's attractive to a lot of people.
I do think that's quite an overly simplistic view of China. I mean, if you read any reports from Africa and the complaints that African people would have against Belt and Road Initiative, it's that, you know, China, you know, give money to African countries to build roads and to build harbors and ports and everything, but then they actually supply the workers themselves as well. So it's not perfect, but it is different to the American sort of American exceptionalism designed empire. You know,
I wonder if that's because.
Sorry.
I was just going to say, I wonder if that's because the Chinese can pay their own workers less than they would have to pay workers in Africa.
I think that is definitely it. A lot of it is they're actually Uyghur Muslims who are slave labor. You know?
Jeez.
Yeah.
It's interesting, like, where the Chinese understand themselves. Like, I remember, like, I once had this student. He almost failed his entire degree. Because he did not know what the word reconcile meant. And he answered this question so badly, he got less than 5% in his final paper. If you get less than 5% in your final paper, you are not allowed to continue your study. So we were chatting one day, and he was from China, and his dad was actually, this is funny, his dad was a toilet roll paper manufacturer for the Chinese state. And off the back of this, he made millions and millions and millions of pounds. So he was paying his son's tuition fees, and he was paying for his son's flat. He was also paying for, he was giving him a monthly allowance. And one day I mentioned to the student, he said something really weird. I can't remember what it was, but he said something bizarre. And I said to him, how much money a year do you think the average British person gets? And he said to me, probably around about £130,000-£140,000. And I said, where did you get this sum of money from? And he said, well, my dad gives me £7,000 a month to spend. And that's what, £94,000, no, that's not right, £84,000 a year. And British people are really wealthy, and they're all wealthier than me. So if I'm making £84,000 a year, and I'm just a student, then the average British person must be making, on a modest salary, £120,000, £130,000, £140,000 a year. And I was like, oh man, how can you come across to the UK? He lived in Southampton, I suppose, which is a bit of a dump. How can you come across to the UK and think, still hold this narrative in your head? But if the government are paying their workers so little, and the narrative is that we are poor and we've got to work hard to be wealthy, then telling them that everyone in the West is really, really well off kind of makes economic and political sense after a while.
Mm. Yeah.
But just in terms of something to come back on, it's not that the point I was raising that Chinese state capitalism isn't predatory, or indeed that China wouldn't want to behave the way America does. It's merely that right now, if you're weighing your options, and if again, in your Africa, you might well see your Ethiopia, and you look at what some of the, or your Afghanistan, you look at what Western investments, whether military or economic, has meant and done. You say, well, if China can't land or won't land or has no interest in landing in with an enormous air force and enforcing things militarily or forcing a different political system down my throat, it's the lesser of two evils argument. And most people do end up choosing what seems slightly less horrible. It's not that China's great. I'm not saying China's great. It's not.
Oh, no.
Saying that if you're weighing your options between the now clearly two spheres of power, you might go with China, especially if you're, thousands of miles away from them and they don't have the capability to fly in and bomb the shit out of you. No.
Sorry, just on that, the people were complaining about, bringing workers in and sort of subverting, their own sort of economy, but they weren't saying, oh no, we don't want investment. It's one of those chicken and egg scenarios. And what can we expect in the future of this, the relationship and the enmity that the West and especially the US has for China?
I suppose your option is if this becomes increasingly polarized, the United States is either going to have to cede its power or it's going to have to try and undermine them economically and politically. I don't really see them ceding their power. So looks like there's going to have to be some sort of political undermining.
Yeah.
Dimitri?
Just add something here. Of course, I'm not a fan of either the US or Chinese capitalism at all, but I have to admit that China has lifted capitalism many levels up. It's state capitalism at its best. It seems to me that China has realized that free market capitalism doesn't work. That's why they prefer to organize everything at the state level and execute it likewise. It's much quicker, much more effective for them. Of course, the culture helps as well because people can obey to an extent and execute the plan. Of course, it's still capitalism. Okay, so we're talking about poor wages, poor worker rights, state control on everything. At the same moment, they are commercially extrovert, but of course a sense of nationalism prevails there as well. How, what else can you do in order to have people on your side despite they are poor? It's nationalism not in, in a way as we know it in the West, but still nationalism, a great tool to keep people quiet, accepting their poor living standards. I'm not saying that Chinese people are poor. Will explained a perfect example there, not at all. But as in everywhere in the world, classes exist, and a class struggle takes place in China as well. I said that previously, China is the wet dream of the Western capitalists. Their system is the ideal one, but the problem here is that people have liberties, liberties that have been fought for years, and it's a big thing of the working class and the people in general. So the Western capitalist states have to find a way to get rid of those liberties if they want to apply a Chinese-like capitalist model. It's not that difficult. They can find ways, like the war of against terrorism is something, in order to have people on their side. Or, I don't know, the coronavirus situation has shown to us that people can get rid of their liberties in order to be safe. I know this is very oxymoron, but it happens. So let's see what the future brings. We have to be prepared ourselves, though.
I would agree. Yeah, definitely.
Do we think this is a model that they're going to try and export, though, is the question I think is very important.
So
what do you think about, maybe more so, do you think they want to, / do you think they can?
Are you saying that China would try to export their capitalist model?
Yeah, I'm asking, do you think they will try, or could they?
I don't think that they will try that, but I believe other states will try to adopt things of the of that model, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like a Hungary, maybe.
Probably. I'm pretty sure they'll try to find their satellites.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can survive in that world. I don't think that the states will ever be like China, but I'm pretty sure they will adopt the state control aspect from China, if they have the chance.
Is it not like a kind of a perfectly timed in many ways, though, because there's such revulsion to the type of what's popularly called democracy, but we all know is actually oligarchic rule through use of media and limiting parliaments. But what people think is democracy, in quotation marks, has been, you know, very badly tarred, justifiably, over the last, you know, certainly since 2008, but probably long before that, as you know, whenever people stop voting in elections and just not taking part and saying politicians are all sociopaths, you know, it's been a while of that. But, you know, a perfectly timed that China can say, well, you know what, you know, there are, you know, technocrats, there are these people who can rule, you don't have to vote, you know, we are good men, you know, because the chairman, Xi Jinping. Excuse my racism. He may look a bit like Winnie the Pooh. He looks a lot like Winnie the Pooh, but he is able to portray himself as this inheritor of Mao, of this noble tradition, and he portrays himself as a kind of flawless leader. And for people who like that sort of thing, and apparently there are some, him saying, no, I'm going to sort things out, I'll solve all these problems. Those Uyghurs you don't like, who don't do things our ways, we're going to put them in re-education camps, that'll solve that problem. Those Tibetans, we're going to flood them with Han Chinese, problem solved. You know, the coronavirus, problem solved as well. We solved, you know, it comes across for people who may be sick of quote-unquote democracy as an alternative. So that's why I was asking, do we think this is something that's going to be exported abroad, whether it's exported or people take it on, you know, it may be more and more attractive.
So what does that look like? That looks like what, more internal authoritarianism with like still like a marketized economy?
Yeah.
I mean, that looks like what it would be to me. I don't imagine the United States or the United Kingdom really giving that power over to the state unless they were being told what to do by massive companies. So like, yeah, I mean, every country in the world, I cannot think of an exception, describes themselves as democratic. Like, the word becomes meaningless. Like, even North Korea describes itself as democratic. Their leader, who may or may not be dead, it's not it's like, what is going on with that? They're saying something like, well, we're ruling on behalf of the people. Like, our leaders know what the will of the people is, and they're executing that will in conformity with their wishes. Democracy has just become a meaningless word, especially when, like, you know, Dominic Cummings in the UK is like sitting in scientific advisory committees, and you know, the United Kingdom's got a queen, and like, it's just, the whole thing's just really, really weird. Like, loads of companies determine Irish.
I'm a prince who claps for the NHS, like a robot.
It really drives me nuts. Like, Prince Charles has never clapped for a thing before in his life. Yeah. He's clearly watched a video
He probably claps when he comes, though, in fairness.
He's across the room, of course, because he's more of a voyeur. So he's sitting in the chair while Camilla's having sex with Prince Andrew. No, he likes younger people, never mind.
Yeah, she's too old. Yeah. They're too old for each other. Gross. if you kind of say to me something like, the state will be directly used by a small set of companies to determine what the policy is in those countries, and that policy is anti-trade union and like anti-workers' rights, then yeah, I'd believe that. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay, so following on from that, what can China's no questions asked aid and financial interest in the Middle East mean for nascent revolutionary movements there? So I'm talking about in the realm of state security and crackdown. So I have a few opinions on this, the Middle East is currently under authoritarian rule, and even Israel and places like that are increasingly being led by autocrats, and I think that there is no space at the minute currently for protest movements of people who want greater freedoms, greater privileges, and also greater responsibilities. And I think that China investing in the Middle East will have a negative impact for those citizens' rights.
Can you tell me what this policy is quickly?
Yeah, it's China's Belt and Road Initiative, and they're investing heavily in Iran, Saudi Arabia, not really so much Israel, but Libya and places like that. So it's almost state capture of sorts.
And what's like the no questions asked section, just for like?
Yeah, so they've told Mohammed bin Salman and Rouhani that, you know, we'll support you financially, and we won't ask you to open up your citizens' rights or anything. And you can spend the money on anything, you know.
Wow, what a great policy! Obviously, being used to support the people of that country, and no other reason at all.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that is, you know, that is the other side of the Belt and Road Initiative, is that, you know, it's being used a lot to sort of pursue weakened countries.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Like, as depressing as it is, in capitalism, including obviously Chinese capitalism, does enjoy a stability. Like, if you've got the options of a revolutionizing leader, or like a leader that's going to like rule with an iron fist, but at least you know what you're going to get, capital always prefers the latter. That's why like the Americans supported Saddam Hussein for so long.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of terrifying.
Yeah, no, I agree.
In terms of revolutionary potential, again, you can turn to what happened with the Arab Spring, which was obviously different depending on where it happened. Tunisia is a much more democratic place than almost anywhere else. Lebanon didn't experience it because it had a horrendous civil war that had basically made it a version of what Northern Ireland is, basically a state that's held together by its sectarian divide. So it does really depend on where you're talking about, in the Maghreb or versus, you know, Middle East. But in terms of what revolutionary forces have emerged over the last 20 or 30 years, they have tended to be Wahhabis.
Nationalists. You know? Well, there's quite a lot.
If you look at Algeria, if you look at Egypt, if you look at Syria, again, there are other movements involved as well, but the groups that gain dominance tended to be Wahhabis.
Islamists is the word, because Wahhabis are Arabian, and it's unique to Arabia. It's unique to a region of
Saudi Arabia, not Iran. The Wahhabism came out of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. It's not Wahhabism in itself. It's Islamism and sort of Islamic nationalism as well, to a lesser extent. You know, but I think there was an interesting time after the Arab Spring, where there was an opportunity for civil society to really stand up and sort of demand changes from the government. And I think that China's involvement in investing in the Middle East after that has been actually quite detrimental to those groups.
I mean, it depends who you talk to, because Robert Fisk, who works for The Independent, wrote a book called The Conquest of the Middle East. He's lived there for, I think, 40 years now.
Yeah.
And is almost as red in the face as I am right now. He said that when he was going around in Tahrir Square, when he was in Lebanon, they don't talk about... The words he didn't hear were democracy, and he didn't hear United States, and he never heard any, or China for that matter. They heard, we want responsible government. We want people to listen to what we have to say. We want more freedoms, but those freedoms don't necessarily mean Western ideas of liberties or whatever. It was quite limited in what they wanted. Now, obviously, the Muslim Brotherhood had their own opinions on what that should mean, and the groups in Syria clearly had their own views of what that should mean. But you know, there is a trade union movement that was very important, certainly in Egypt and in Turkey. Sorry, Turkey, pardon me, in Iraq in previous years. But it seems to me that we might be looking at it from too much of a Western perspective.
I wasn't couching the question in terms of, you know, democracy as a Western concept, but I'm more saying that, you know, responsible government, which you mentioned, you know, that's been undermined by China's investments in the Middle East recently, because they're giving the money to the state and not to civil state organizations and stuff, you know. So
think about like the role of like Twitter and stuff and kicking off the Arab Spring.
Yeah.
That just could not happen in China. Because of amazing like infrastructure. I say amazing, and like it's incredible in terms of its like coding, but also it's incredible in terms of I can't believe they're doing it. But they've got like remarkable lockdown on their communications.
Whereas in
Egypt and Tunisia and Lebanon and places like this, they had less of a control because the state just wasn't or didn't invest as much in their I suppose if China is investing all this money into these countries, one of the things the Chinese can export is their firewall and their ability to like monitor you know, different means of communication. It's obviously worrying. The thing we're using just now is end-to-end encrypted and open source. Would this be allowed in China? I would be amazed if it would be allowed in China. Would Telegram be allowed in China? No way. Yeah. Signal would not be allowed in China either. It's hard to see like a way out for countries that are starting to develop these technologies, utilize these technologies. And if Chinese investment is being used to stop those conversations happening, then its potential impact on revolutionary activity is staggering. It may just shut the conversation down by not allowing it to happen in the first place.
No, I agree with that. So then the final question I have is, why are the US so opposed to China's involvement in Middle Eastern economies when they themselves seem to be making a withdrawal from their own environment in the area?
Is it one of those things where, like, you have a girlfriend and then you like leave your girlfriend or your boyfriend and then you see your friend going out with them and then you're like, hold on a second, mate, what are you doing? Is it one of these things? Is it, do you think it's just like...
I was honestly about to say that. That's kismet there.
Really. We're obviously a bunch of jilted men.
Yeah. Like, I'm married. What are you talking about?
Yeah. I agree. It's more like, no, I don't want, my enemy's enemy is my friend. And I don't want the Middle East, you know, to go on China's side because, you know, of all the oil and stuff that we'd be missing out on as well. So, you know.
What was that? There was like
slavery
in the United Kingdom was abolished. And like, man, they are really proud of themselves for like abolishing slavery. But they only did it because the French were getting richer off it than they were. Like, this is the only reason why. There was like an economic reason. And I wonder if something like that's happening here as well. Like, America are no longer getting as rich as they wanted to off oil.
Yeah.
But man, they don't want China to like benefit from that.
Mm.
Dimitrios?
Dimitri?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Just add something on Ocean's last question there. Oil is not the only interest for China in the Middle East. Something that we have to consider is the conflict with China's own way to...
Sorry, Dimitrios, your sound is there's a lot of reverb. I'm not sure if anyone else is getting it. But
I can hear it, yeah.
Yeah.
Better now?
Yeah, better.
Yeah.
So transport routes is something we have to consider as kind of main interest for China in the Middle East as well. Don't forget that 2 years ago, the only way for China to export goods was through their ports. But we know that the sea is an open ground for conflicts there. Piracy is a thing at that part of the world.
The Gulf of Oman, yeah.
In order to be very effective in transporting their goods to Europe and other parts of the world, they had to come into agreement with everyone else, with every other country in Asia and Middle East. That's why they are buying out countries themselves now. They are building cities, they are building roads, they are building all the infrastructure, and they can move in very, very reducing times, much quickly and much more effective into Europe. From the time that they control the main transporting routes, they don't really care about the ports in Vietnam, for example. They can have Vietnam on their side, but it's not really necessary. That's why they have come into agreement with India, Pakistan, everyone else apart from Saudi Arabia, for obvious reasons, of course. Saudi Arabia is considered for the Chinese as a destabilization factor in the area, so they don't really need them, but they can go through Europe using everyone else. Oil, of course, is a thing still, and it will be a thing in the next coming years, but let's not underestimate the transport routes over there.
Yeah, well, that's why the Belt and Road Initiative is called the Belt and Road Initiative. They want to sort of connect China to the world, you know.
Can I just mention a kind of, again, historical point, which is that after World War II, besides the... Whoop, what was that noise? Whoever that was, stop that. But anyway, after World War II, there was a meeting between, I can't remember who it was, one of the members of the House of Saud, and it was either Truman, it might have been before the end of the war, to be honest with you, because I think it was FDR who was still alive.
Yeah.
And FDR looking pretty peaky, met with him, and an arrangement was made. But in general, you have a transfer. The British Empire could no longer maintain security arrangements, could no longer extend its power, and neither could the French, really, into the Middle East. And America moved in because they viewed it as a lever of power for the Middle East for geostrategic, economic reasons. Oil was part of it, don't get me wrong. It was a huge prize to be had. And if you could control that area, you were the world's hegemon. That was the theory, anyway. So it could be the fact that America is facing many, many problems. Its withdrawal from the Middle East is necessitated by the domestic opinion, by the military overreach, by all sorts of different things, but does not mean that they would like that to be the case. Clearly the CIA, clearly the American military would rather that they were able to maintain their bases indefinitely in Iraq and indefinitely in northern Syria, you know, in Rojava, you know. They would much prefer that to be the case. But they can't do it. and they're now facing that the thing of having to withdraw from many areas. But they would rather not do that. So the question is about China, if they're withdrawing, well, they don't want to withdraw. They're being forced to withdraw. I mean, you could look at any different example. I mean, they recently did a deal with the Taliban, for fuck's sake. They were there for, what, 19, 20 years? Clearly, they didn't suddenly decide, ooh, this is a good idea to leave. It's because it's no longer possible for them to do this.
Yeah, so the problem against it.
Yeah, so they have to do it. So the point with China is not that they're somehow hoisting them out of the area. It's that America can't do it anymore. It's lost the ability to control the key lever of power. And that's why we're entering a world which is multipolar, which we already have been entering for a long time anyway. So there was you mentioned the interregnum. The interregnum was that period where it wasn't clear if there's a global hegemon. It's now very clear that there isn't one. And that America may be the first amongst the great powers, but it's no longer the hegemon anymore. And that's a dangerous world because, historically speaking, that type of multipolar world has always led to war. Because it just has. So that's the real, I think, danger with China, because it's a signifier of what, not so much they're going to be replaced and usurp America. It's just we're going to now exist in a world where allies of the two big or three big polar powers or four, however many there are, will be increasingly fighting in more than economic trade wars. That's a real danger for everyone, every human or any living thing on this planet, you know?
Yeah, I would agree with that, definitely. Dimitris, do you have anything to add?
I'd like to mention a couple of things that I came across recently makes me think that the U.S. are losing the war in every field against China. First of all, the U.S. Naval Institute, a right-wing think tank, has recently released a statement urging for privateering in order to stop China's growth and eventual domination in the sea. And that sounds amazing, doesn't it? Privateering piracy from individuals, not the state. So that's a statement from an official right-wing think tank in America. So it could be a thing that we will see in the next coming months, years, I don't know. But I'm quite surprised that they say that so openly. And the second thing that I came across again was a couple of weeks ago or a week ago, a law firm called Bergman Law Group has filed a class action complaint against the Chinese government for their failures to contain the coronavirus, which sounds ridiculous, but is it probably a new war field for the US against China?
Well, litigation, like China's intellectual property laws are non-existent at this stage, and they have a whole line of cars that look exactly the same as Mercedes and all that. So, I mean, I think if you want to contain China for the short term, it probably would be through suing them. You know,
who's like the authority there? So let's say I take you to court, we've got an external arbiter that's going to decide which of us is in the right. If America sues China for like not putting enough bleach in the injections or whatever, if America does that and China say okay, no, what happens then?
I'd say we go back to privateering, because the US state has to compensate those that filed the case, you know, and that's the only way to take, you know, advantage of all the ships or properties of Chinese state in the US.
All right, just like claim their assets, you mean?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds silly, but that's why I'm saying that I see it as a win-win situation for both. It sounds like an answer for everything.
It sounds like the worst Alien versus Predator movie ever.
Yeah.
That was still Requiem. Requiem is still the worst. Don't even dare. Even this isn't as bad. I've had a very long pandemic. I've watched a lot of shitty movies.
I reduced myself yesterday to watching Hitman Agent 47. I've played Hitman 2 and completed it all, and then I thought, I'm going to watch this film. It's the worst film.
It's just Hitman Oliphant, the Russian.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Oh, man. Just awful.
Do you know what's a great film? to watch over and over again because it never gets old. Predator. Predator is a great movie. There's so much homoeroticism in it. It's unbelievable. It's just like the camera's lingering on oiled up biceps. You know, and the Predator kills them all. So I mean, what's not to love?
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I know. Never would have guessed with Predator, would you?
It has been out for about 30 years, so I mean,
well, that's fair.
If people don't
get to the chopper. Dimitri.
My last point, and probably a topic for another podcast, why are the lefties in the West so obsessed with China?
Because they call themselves communists.
Yeah, that's not a film recommendation, Dimitri.
Sorry?
That's not a film recommendation.
But seriously, it's because they call themselves communists. And once upon a time, Maoism was a kind of what they called, they used to call themselves, not third way. They had their own separate thing. They wanted to kind of, Maoism was a big part of third world, wasn't it?
I like playing with words, though.
Yeah. Well, they're clearly not communists, but then they weren't communists when Mao was in charge either. But
yeah,
again,
I'm surprised because it's not only the Maoists, it's all the lefts actually obsessed with China, as if a class antagonism doesn't take place there at the moment.
Well, I mean, it depends who you're talking to. I know people who were in the Workers' Party in Ireland, which doesn't really have a British equivalent, and they're obsessed with China in the same way they're obsessed with Assad, because the word socialist or communist in the case of China is used, and they really do think Assad is this great guy, apparently. I don't know why, but they do. And I've heard multiple members of the Workers' Party defend Chinese capitalism as basically an extension of what Lenin did with the new economic policy back in the 20s, basically using an element of capitalism to develop a bourgeois class, basically to do a kind of a very rigid version of Marx's kind of historical materialism. You have to go through these stages, you know? That's what they say. And they say they're just doing that, but then they're going to switch it all around. And that's why Xi Jinping is so great, because he is actually bringing Mao back into it, you know?
Yeah.
Are they still killing landlords?
No.
Aww.
They're just killing Uyghurs now and innocent people. So
damn it.
I know. No fun.
Come on, guys.
Will we leave it at that?
Yeah,
sounds good. Yeah. Like, final thought is obviously China needs to get back on the killing landlords wagon. Americans get on well with injecting bleach. I need to buy more cars. People need to donate money for me to do that. And film suggestions would be welcome, because I'm bored off my arse. So
Predator 1 and 2. In fact, I would say Predator 2 is beautifully bad. It's like it's hard to explain. Have you ever seen Predator 2?
I don't think I have.
Oh, Predator 2 is such. It's like a slightly diluted version of RoboCop. You know, RoboCop's amazing.
Yeah. I love RoboCop.
Predator 2 is good for reasons that don't make sense. It's so weird, and it's so sweaty, and it's like, because people are sweating all the time in it, and you have to see it. It's just so beautiful.
So, like, I think that's an official recommendation from the anarchists in Ireland. Is that the most?
Yeah, Predator 1 because it's homoerotic, and Predator 2 because it's sweaty.
Great. Beautiful.
And, Will, I've just thought, what about Red Joan for a name for your car? You know, that's you're placating the feminists and the communists in that. So.
Oh, I could call it like Red Rosa or something, you mean?
Yeah,
that's sweet. So, like, okay, so like, I'll need a new car fairly soon, I reckon. I'll create a Twitter poll or something, and you can name my car.
Yeah.
An electric car?
That's the hope, is that I'm going to get an electric car. I think the UK made it illegal to buy, an electric petrol car after 2025, maybe 2030. I've forgotten what year it is, but there'd be not much point in me buying a petrol car at this point anyway. So
you could be one of those really weird guys who have like ham sandwiches in their pocket, and they hook the engine up to run on fuel that they get from chippers, you know.
I was watching Irish politicians.
Yeah.
I got a ham sandwich in your pocket. riding this.
Anyway. Well, there you go. Top anarchist right. recommendations, ham sandwich powered car, Predator 2.
So that's us for this issue of Anime Podcast. I'm going to leave you off with a nice song by a North Korean band in honor of Mr. Kim Jong-un, who may or may not be dead. Who knows? And it's called Excellent Horse-Faced Lady, which is a strange title. There you go. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.